5th century. And if any of us ever studied any history books, and we look at what people were like, whether it was 300 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, and any of the great centers of civilization, one thing which is very striking is just the similarity of emotional temperament which people have retained over such a long time. In just the same way that Buddhism, the teaching, the practice, the philosophy, has supplied something very valuable to people 2,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago, or even today. It shows that there is something here in these teachings which is timeless. And the reason why these teachings have survived is because it's offered something. It's offered some aid, some help, something which people have found delighting. What it's offered is both philosophical knowledge, understanding of one's position in this world, one's place in the universe, offering answers to the question of why and how, and what should I be doing, where did I come from. It also offers not just the answers to these questions, but also it offers a sense of increased emotional well-being, a sense of increasing happiness. And it solves problems, problems on the daily life. It's not only does it answer one's inner philosophical question, but also creates greater happiness in the heart. And it creates greater harmony in the community, in the society. And if it wasn't doing these things, then it would never survive so long. And many of you who have been coming here for many weeks, many months, many years, have seen the different aspects of Buddhism presented. Those aspects which we may call like the knowledge teaching, those teachings which we may call the how to be happier teachings, and those teachings how to live in a happier, more harmonious society type of teaching. This is what Buddhism has offered in all of these times. So have other religions, so have other philosophies. But one of the things which makes Buddhism stand out is its practical advice. Instead of just saying that God created the universe or didn't create the universe, that after death you'll go to heaven if you're good, or you won't go to heaven, you'll just disappear. Instead of saying there is reincarnation or there's not reincarnation or rebirth, whichever you wish to call it. Instead of saying to be happy you have to be virtuous, be good people, be kind to one another. Instead of saying that to have a harmonious society we should keep these moral precepts, we should practice generosity, sharing, compassion, kindness, forgiveness towards one another. Instead of saying all of these things which one will find in other philosophies and other teachings, one of the things which I, in my experience, when I first met Buddhism, which really stood out, was the richness of methods which was presented in Buddhism, the how to achieve these things. It's all right saying that there is a God, there isn't a God, there is a soul, there isn't a soul, that after death one will go here or one will not go here. But in the end, how does one know? Or to put it another way, how can one know? Either one just has some sort of belief and just throws the dice, so to speak, and gambles that what one hears is, sounds right, feels right, and must be right. But that's no real surety. Quite often, and many of you have experienced this, what feels like, what sounds right is wrong. And we've all had that experience of seeing something or seeing, hearing somebody and thinking, this must be right, this sounds so good, this is just what I want, this is just how it is, this is just how I think. And then later on realizing that one was wrong and the teacher was wrong. So we do need some means of knowing for ourselves the truth of, or the answers to such questions about the origin of being, of what the essence of being is, of what the purpose of being is, and what its goal is. We need some way of knowing all of this. And what the Buddhism was very, stood out very clearly for me was that it gave one a very good and clear and effective and workable way of answering these questions for oneself. Not depending upon somebody else, not believing in some holy book or some experienced teacher, but finding out for oneself inside one's own heart. And it's the same with the way to one's own inner happiness. Just believe me, do this, and you'll be happy. Instead of believing other people, there was a very clear path. And with the harmony in between human beings, the Buddha taught a very clear path. This is where Buddhism is extremely strong in its method for achieving all that we really wish for as human beings. These methods which the Buddha taught, however, are not easy. Otherwise, everyone would be enlightened, everyone would be happy, everyone would be living in harmony, and everyone would know the answer to these big questions which human beings have been asking for centuries. Our experience shows us that very few people know what real happiness is, let alone other people who experience true happiness. And we all know just how many arguments there are, how many differences of opinion there are on these big questions of existence. Whether one asks scientists or philosophers or people of religion, it's very rare that one gets an agreement here. So the point is that very few people do know. This is a difficult path, but Buddhism does offer the path to know the answers to one's questions, to know the real meaning of happiness and the way to achieve it, and to know how to live in harmony, how to improve the society in which we live in. And this evening I wanted to talk about this way, this path, this how we achieve it. Some people think that this is just through knowledge, through listening to talks, through coming here every Friday night, through reading the books in the library, through listening to the tapes. Knowledge is helpful. It clears much of the path, especially the beginnings of the path, but eventually we have to walk this path which the Buddha taught. The Buddha said he could point the way to self-realization, to self-experience of true happiness, to self-knowledge. There is a way, but it has to be walked each person by themselves. And the way which he taught, this path which he taught, and the subject of this talk this evening, is this path of meditation. And especially the way of meditation, which the Buddha called Samatha and Vipassana, loosely translated as calm and insight. This was the Buddha's way which he found himself. This is what the Buddha did to achieve what he called was full wisdom of the nature of all things. This is what the Buddha did to achieve what he said was the greatest happiness which ever any human being could ever achieve. For example, one day, one of the great kings, the great Maharajas of India at that time, and India at that time, 2,500 years ago, was a very wealthy land. And the king would say, why are you a monk? It's a question people ask these days. And the Buddha said, for the sake of happiness. And for this the king was surprised. How can you be happy, someone who lives out in the forest, who sleeps under trees, who is cold or too hot, who has no protection from the insects and mosquitoes? Here am I, said the king, I have a palace, I have guards, I can eat whatever I want, whenever I want. I have women whenever I need them, whenever I want them. Everything which a person can have to satisfy their pleasures, I can have at my command. How can you be happy? And the Buddha said that, he told this king, he said, can you live for 7 days experiencing uninterrupted bliss? And the king says, well, no, I mean, sometimes, you know, things go wrong, this is to be done, sometimes I've got aches and pains in my body. I'm happy most of the time. And the Buddha was saying, I'm happy all of the time. 100% bliss for 7 days. This was the Buddha's happiness, and there was a path to this. And the Buddha once said that he doesn't argue with anyone in the world. It shows a sense of harmony in his life, in his lifestyle, with his community. Again, how did he achieve that? through his own practice, through his own understanding, through his own development of what we call samatha and vipassana, the calm and insight. And this is the way which Buddhas over 25 centuries have developed themselves in order to gain understanding, happiness, and be a benefit for the community around them. Through this practice, the practice of calm and insight needs a foundation, and the foundation which the Buddha said should be developed prior to the full undertaking of meditation is the development of virtue. Virtue is just the clearing of the great obstacles on the path, especially the obstacles on the beginning. It's very hard for someone to practice meditation if their life is full of troubles, if their life is very disturbed, because of the lack of a peaceful lifestyle. Virtue is just that, a peaceful way of living. Virtue is speech which doesn't cause problems to other people or to oneself. Technically, they say, bad speech is lying, is harsh speech which puts down another person, which angers another person, slanderous speech, spreading rumors, spreading gossip. And I can see why this is bad speech, because it doesn't lead to calmness in one's own heart, it doesn't lead to calmness in the community one is living with, whether that's a family, whether that's a monastic community, or whether that's a city or a country. In order to create a foundation for developing this calm and insight, we need to have a very clean and clear lifestyle. It's as if before one really needs to meditate, one has to clean one's room up to get rid of the dust and the dirt so that one can meditate reasonably undistracted. If the room is dirty, it attracts all sorts of little animals and insects which bite you. It's not a very conducive atmosphere for the calming and the clearing of the mind. So we start the practice of samatha and vipassana with just basic virtue. Being good people. Being harmless people. Harmless to oneself, harmless to others. Without that sense of harmlessness, one's life will be too busy sorting out problems. How busy is our life? What do we spend most time doing in our life? Just sorting out the basic problems of existence, the struggle to survive. It's amazing just how simple life becomes when one starts to live virtuously. How easy it is if we just gave up drinking, gave up gambling, gave up lying, gave up unchastity, gave up bad speech. How much time is wasted at work through careless speech, through speech which hurts other people? How much time is wasted in societies because of stealing or cheating or alcohol problems? So much time is wasted. Virtue clears a path, it gives one time, it gives one the space in which to start calm and insight. So once we have developed a sense of virtue, then we can really get down to grips with calming the mind and developing insight. The question comes, why do we need to calm the mind before we develop insight? Can't we just investigate a particular aspect of nature and just find out for ourselves? Now look at your own mind and how it works. If you really want to understand something, what do you do? Quite often we look at it and we think about it. And if you're really careful and look at the way we think, we just think about what we already know about it. And when we think in that way, we never actually see it. To be able to understand something, we have to go to the limit of our knowledge and go beyond. Otherwise, we tend to think, I know, and we let it go, we pass it over to something else. The problem with the human mind, we never spend enough time on an object to really know it. You can choose any object, maybe the object closest to you, the back in front of you, or the person's back in front of you. That's just the person's back. When you say that, when the mind says, I know what that object is, the the mind is done with it and it gets on to something else. In order to gain insight, true understanding, to notice something, we have to look a bit deeper than that. We have to say, look at this object in front of us. The mind says, that's just something ordinary, simple. We see it, we say we know it, but then we ask again, look further. Don't just give this up, look further. Whether it's the person's back, whether it's the bag in front of you, whether it's the carpet. You see, that's just a carpet in front of you. Look closer. The more you hold that object in your mind without moving away from it, the more you start to see and understand of that object. I have done this many times with all sorts of objects, many objects which I thought had nothing to teach me. I like to tell the story of when I was watching a piece of concrete in a monastery in Thailand. Concrete is something which is unnatural, which is ugly. That's why people put carpets and tiles on it, so they don't see it. What an ugly building it is, which is just all concrete and glass. So you just look at a piece of concrete and open your mind to it. Keep the mind still, calm on that object, and just see what opens up to you. A piece of concrete can become very beautiful. The different shades, the colors, the textures, in that very simple, ordinary object which we pass by so often, are there, but we never notice. This is just an example which shows the need for calm, this need for not knowing, this need for open stillness on an object, the need why we have to have this in order to understand what we're looking at. Another person, a friend of ours from here, told me some years ago that his daughter had married her husband many years before, maybe 18, 19 years before. And for those 18 or 19 years, they'd always been so busy building a home, raising a family, paying off the mortgage. They never really had much time for themselves. And he said that after 18, 19 years of marriage, the children were grown up enough that they could go off on a holiday by themselves for the first time. And this man told me that his daughter had come back from that holiday astounded. And she said to him, this is the first time I've really got to know the man I'd married. All the time before, they'd always been doing things, always on the run. Never time to really look at one another and be with one another and find out about one another. So they were always doing something. For 18 years, they had lived together, but never known one another. This is just ordinary insight of life. Unless we stop long enough to look very carefully, silently, without thinking we know the other person, we never will get to know them. We do put one another in pigeonholes. I know her, I know him. She's like this, he's like that. This monkey's this way or that way. Be careful of those judgments. As soon as we say, I know, we never look any further, do we? We go on to something else. This insight of this knowledge about a person, about a thing, we have to stop, realize we don't know everything, and keep on looking, calm. And then insight, understanding starts to arise. You start to see things which we never thought were there before. You start to realize that concrete can be beautiful. That a person you thought you knew has other sides to them which you never thought ever existed. So in order to develop even ordinary insight, we do need calm. Without insight, we have no understanding about concrete, about people, about life. If we really want to understand life, we have to stop long enough to see it. Because life is so fast, it runs by so quickly. So we have to stop and look, and not understand it, but wait for it to teach us what it needs to do. If we want to understand ourselves, we have to stop and look very carefully inside, in order to understand how we work. Look inside your mind right now. How much can you see? Things travel so fast inside the mind. Thoughts go so quickly. It's very hard to stay with one thought long enough to really understand it. You've all tried meditation just previously. How hard it is to stop the mind just what a breath without something else interrupting and butting in and taking your attention away. How hard it is to know one whole breath. So how hard it is to know the way you work inside, your mental world, your world of emotions, the world of grief and pain and fear and desire, the world of hopes and despairs. How hard that is to know, because the mind is not still. It rushes over these things, it glosses over these things, and never stays long enough to understand. Because we don't understand these things, we're either afraid of them or in their power. Have you ever seen a ghost? If you've seen a ghost and you turn around and face it, it's not frightening anymore. The only power a ghost has over you is to keep you running away. Fear. And there are many ghosts in the mind which we run away from, which we never turn around to face up to. If we're always running away, keeping our backs to these things, we never know them, we're in their power, we have no control over them. Those things are fear, grief, pain, anger, disappointments, lack of self-esteem. We run away from these things. By running away from these things, we try to get rid of them. We try to escape from them. We try and find some place where pain, where criticism, where disappointment is not. We run away. When we run away, it means we never can spend time to turn around and look and find out what is it that's actually chasing us. What is chasing you through your life? Sometimes people say that I am chasing something. I'm chasing success. I'm chasing money. I'm chasing the perfect relationship. I'm chasing enlightenment. But actually, it's these things chasing you. Why not stop for a while, turn around and have a look what's chasing you? This is the practice of insight. Stopping is calm. Turning around and looking is insight. In particular, as Buddhists, we look at the way we work, we look at our emotional world. We look at things like disappointment, we look at things like... Let's just say disappointment for a while. The Buddha said that suffering is being separated from what you like, or being associated with what you don't like. Put it that way, and half the time we're not with what we like, or in other words, we're with what we don't like. So much of life is just out of our control. We try, we aspire, but we don't always succeed. If you look at it that way, that disappointment is natural, unavoidable, if we want something. What do you want? What do you really like? What are the chances of you getting it? If you answer those questions, you feel that maybe I might achieve it, maybe I won't. So one is letting oneself in for disappointment. Disappointment is always a result of these desires. If you desire, if you really want something, you have to accept the probability of disappointment. This is part of the course. As has been said to it many times, it's like a person joining the army has to accept the possibility of being wounded or killed. That's part of the course. What do you expect when you join an army? What do you expect if you desire something, if you want something, if you want something very badly? You can expect to be disappointed. So if one wishes to overcome 90% of disappointment in life, it's very easy. Don't want so much. Have fewer likes. Have fewer demands on life. And disappointment is reduced enormously. Of course, this is obvious. But why can't we see it? All that is ours, beloved and pleasing, the Buddha said, will one day become separated from me. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing. Everything which you really love and like, which is so important to you, eventually will become separated from you. If not before, or then at least at death. It is obvious when you think about it, but why don't we notice it? Because we're always running away from disappointment. We're always running away from the fear of being separated from that which we love. We never turn around and face up to it. These are simple things. But if we understand these things, what is the result? If we really understand deeply in our heart, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. What's the result of that? Is it like morbidity? Just depression? What's life really worth? No, that's not the result. Try it, and what do you find? You find because things are impermanent, because all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day go, it means you look after it. It means you value it. It means that you're not heedless in the way you live your life with those people and things around you which are dear. If you realize that you only have a few more days left with the person you love, what would you do? Why don't you do that now? Understanding the impermanency of these things with insight actually enriches life. We put more effort into life. We care more in life. The people around us, the people we're with, we really like, we're more caring to them. If one really understood this was one's last day with one's husband, with one's wife, with one's parents, with one's children, with one's favorite monk, then you'd be very kind, very caring. You've only got one day together, and then you'd have a wonderful time. Of course, this may be our last day, this may be our last year, this may be our last 10 years, certainly our last 100 years. So we care. When we understand these things with insight, it surprises us. Understanding impermanence actually eradicates fear. It doesn't make more fear. Understanding the fact that which we love, which we care for, will one day be set over for us, enriches life. Makes us more vital, more alive, more caring, rather than depressed. Try it and see. But insight goes further than this yet. These are just ordinary insights which we can discover for ourselves just by what we call reflecting on life, thinking clearly. Insight goes further than this. Insight goes right to the very depths of the mind, how you work. Because there are some emotions, especially in our lives, which are very troublesome, which give us enormous problems. The emotion of ego, always wanting to please other people, always wanting to be well regarded, being sort of very afraid of criticism, wounded so easily, being so sensitive to the slightest put down, this feeling that one isn't really worth much. This is an emotion which can create great turmoil in the human being, the wounding of the inner person. There is the pain of the body which creates great turmoil. We have this very sensitive body of skin with all the nerves on the outside, just where we can be hurt. It would be wonderful if all the nerves were deep within, so it wouldn't really matter. We wouldn't feel so pain. The center of pain would be protected, but that's not the way our bodies are. We hurt so easily, and we have to endure pain, and the pain gets worse the older we get. We get old age, we get sick. Eventually we have to face, sooner or later, the pain of death. These can be great fears if we run away from pain, but with insight we can stop running, stop and look, calm and insight, and find out what pain really is. With pain there's always the two aspects, there's the physical feeling and the emotional response. Again, you cannot understand this until one day the pain is so much you stop and have to face it. What's the usual response to pain? Running away. Escaping. Trying to find some way of overcoming that pain or escaping from it. That way you never understand pain. It's like the ghost always chasing us. When you turn around to the ghost and you go boo back, the ghost disappears or runs off. The ghost is much more scared of you than you are of him. Or it, or she. So, insight stops, looks, and conquers. What was it? Julius Caesar said, I came, I saw, and I conquered. That's what insight does. We go very deep, and we solve these problems. What a wonderful thing it would be if you knew how to be above and beyond pain. Physical pain. What a wonderful thing it would be if you were above and beyond fear. What a wonderful thing it would be if you were above and beyond disappointment, where you could participate in this world and you could try your very best, put forth all your effort, and if it fails, never mind, so what? Are you ever disappointed? Do you ever buy a lottery ticket and then find that you don't win? Oh well, never mind. Do you ever build a monastery and think, as I did 3 years ago, that the whole thing burned down in a bushfire? Oh well. It's amazing when actually you can do that. And there's a sense of no disappointment at all. No fear. No worry about pain. What a wonderful freedom that would be. Choose the word carefully, freedom. Freedom from that which worries, which concerns, which afflicts most human beings. It would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Can you understand the bliss of the Buddha? The happiness, the freedom? This is the path. Calm and insight, stopping and facing, understanding, conquering. Sounds easy, doesn't it? The way we stop is very important, first of all. Stopping is the samatha meditation. Calm. Stopping the flow of thinking, conceptualizing. Stopping even the flow of thinking. Calming the mind down, stilling it, making it so still. There's not a sound going on inside. There's not a movement, not an ebb, not a wobble in the mind. Completely one-pointed. One experience in the mind. From moment to moment to moment to moment, with no movement, with no change. The changeless, peaceful, unified state of mind, which comes through the practice of samatha. Actually, to understand deeply into the mind, you have to have deep calm. Shallow calm means shallow insight. Deep calm means deep insight. And even though that we can stop and look at life like pain, we never really understand it deeply until we can stop the mind so much, until things are just so calm and peaceful and silent, it's more peaceful than you'd ever could conceive in this world. A silence which is more silent than the deepest cave, which is more silent than outer space, because nothing is happening at all. A great silence in the mind, a great emptiness of deep meditation. That actually has some remarkable effects. First of all, one has the insight that such experiences actually exist. Insight is just one's personal experience of the reality of this situation. In this particular case, a situation of perfect peace. This is real. This can be experienced by a human being because you experience it for yourself through this method. And the amazing thing about this experience is that this is happiness. The bliss of peace surpasses any other happiness which human beings can find in this world. It surpasses the holiday to Bali, it surpasses sexual intercourse, it surpasses heroin, it surpasses the highest physical pleasure which you can experience. It surpasses the happiness of winning $5 million on the lotto. So why bother getting a lotto ticket? Just come and meditate. Why don't people do that? Because it's harder to meditate. It doesn't take much to buy a lotto ticket. So actually put forth the time and the effort and the care to develop these states of mind is very hard. But it's there, it's possible, there's a way, there's a path. Everything worthwhile in this world costs. Not money. It doesn't cost great intelligence, it costs just time, effort, carefulness. And so this insight comes that this is actual happiness in deep meditation. The deeper you get, the more bliss there is. But it's a bliss of a different sort. Not what you would expect bliss to be. Not tears streaming down the eyes. Tears streaming down the eyes is a very actually core state of meditation. So bliss is much more refined than that. Peace is more silent. And one explores, one gets insight into what's possible for the human being to experience. Where the mind can actually go. This great universe within. You know what, that question a friend of his daughter, only 5 or 6 years old daughter was asked at school, what's the biggest thing in the world? The teacher asked. Someone said an elephant, someone said a mountain, someone said the whole earth. This little daughter said the I is the biggest thing in the world. The teacher said, what do you mean? And this little child, only 5 or 6 years old, said, well, the eye can see an elephant, it can see the mountain, it can even see the earth. Therefore, the eye must be bigger. It can see all those things and much more. What a brilliant answer that was. The eye is the biggest thing in the world. But it wasn't quite right, because the mind is bigger than the eye. The mind can see all those things, and it can also hear as well. And actually, it can imagine things which you can never see. The mind is the biggest thing in the whole universe, in the whole of existence. Your mind. There, anything can exist. And more. Things which you don't imagine can exist. This huge territory of the mind. And in that territory of the mind is enormous expanses of pure bliss and quiet and stillness. Just knowing that much is an enormous insight. In fact, the deeper one goes into those states, the more insight one has that these are the real happiness of the human being. And what's the result of that? One gives up those pursuits which most people in the world think is happiness. You're not interested in the holidays in Bali. You're not interested in alcohol, drugs. You're not interested in the movies. You're not even interested in sexual intercourse. Is something which is more pleasurable. This is an insight which leads to liberation. But more than that, it's an these states of mind lead to enormous power and clarity. Those of you who have done some meditation should, I hope by now, realize that the more peaceful the mind is, afterwards, when you first come out of meditation, just how clear and powerful your mind is. I first knew this in a very coarse way, just when I meditated between my final examinations at university. 3-hour exam in the morning, 3-hour in the afternoon in theoretical physics. Yuck. And that was really hard work. Those were the days when final examinations counted for everything. You passed or failed just on those series of exams. I was very tense, the pressure was on, I was told my whole life would depend upon these examinations. It didn't do me much good now, being a monk, but never mind. At the time I believed that these were very, very important. During the middle of the day we had 1 hour in which we were supposed to go back and have something to eat. I went without food, I meditated instead. My meditation wasn't that strong in those days, but it was strong enough that I could let go of all the nervousness, all the tiredness, all of the confusion of thinking, how did I do? Is that the right answer to that question? What questions are going to be asked in the afternoon? All of that you can let go of, and it goes to a very peaceful, quiet state where you relax. You rest. So when you came out of only 30 minutes meditation, the mind was so clear, so sharp, so rested, I could go into that afternoon examination and did very well. I could access the information which I'd learned at the lectures, which I tried to memorize. I could write clearly and think clearly. Why? Because my mind was clear. Thoughts and worried and taking that nervous tension and tiredness into the afternoon examination, I would never have done so well. See what meditation does? It gives power. It is clarity, even this at this coarse level. Imagine what it's like when the mind is so powerful and strong, gets into very deep states. Just how powerful and how sharp the mind is, how clear it is. Then we can start to look at those questions. Does God exist? What is the meaning of God anyway? Is there such a thing as a soul? What is a soul? What do I take as a soul? What do we really mean by impermanence, which we keep on talking about here? You don't know what impermanence is, don't you? If you really did, you'd be enlightened. Fully. Why don't we know? What about love, compassion, being kind? Do you really know what love really is? Honest. When there is this powerful, clear state of mind to see, and from that calming of the mind, in deep meditations, in jhanas, the emerging mind is so powerful, so clear, whatever it looks upon, it is as if that thing jumps out to you. You see it so vividly, you see its characteristics so clearly. Whatever you see, you have a very, very strong chance of understanding. It's like having a powerful beam of light shining on something. If the beam of light is dim, you only see its outline, its silhouette. If the beam of your light is very powerful and strong, created by this calmness of the mind, whatever you look at just is so clear, whether it's a questions and examination, or whether it's the deeper questions of the universe, you see the answers. You understand the questions. And you know for yourself, there's no such thing as God. You can argue with me. No, that's wrong. What do you mean by God anyway? You know for yourself, you see. Because how do you know? I can't tell you. Just go into meditation. Calm your mind down. Make your mind so peaceful, so strong, so sharp. Take your mind to the limit with peace. And look. Look to see if there's even a soul there. A me, an I. You cannot see that very clearly or very easily. When the mind is quiet and powerful, it's strong, and you answer these questions for yourself, and it gives you an insight which is, in the words of the Buddha, unshakable. Whatever anyone else says, you've seen, you've known through your own experience. You know, when one's understanding is unshakable, you don't really care so much about convincing other people. Other people do to do with you, shrug one's shoulders. It's only when you're unsure that you want to convince others. I'm right, aren't I? That's why we try and convince others. When you're showing yourself, when you're seeing for yourself, when you have this opening of the eye inside, this uncertainty is abolished. Uncertainty as the philosophical question, uncertainty as to the way and meaning of happiness, and uncertainty into how to be in harmony with other people. You've cracked the problem. You've seen behind the curtain. You've understood these meanings of life. And all wonderful things follow as a result of this. So one knows what happiness is, then one can go to it any time one likes. A deep peace in the mind. So one knows when one has this powerful mind, one can scan one's personality. One can scan the way the mind works and other people's minds work. And one gets this marvelous understandings of human nature, of how we work, and how we, what can be fixed, and what needs to be replaced, or when the vehicle needs just to be taken down to the pit, and you get a new one. We understand because we've seen inside our own hearts. And our hearts, my heart, is the same model as your heart. It works pretty much the same way, and it's been this way for 2,500 years. Through one's own personal experience and understanding, one looks back at what the Buddha said, and one cries. One cries in realization just what a perfect expression of reality is in those Buddhist teachings. And how for 2,500 years, monks and nuns, men and women, have experienced that same realization of the Buddha, and have also looked back upon those teachings and have said, yes, this is true to the Dhamma, it is true to the meaning of life. That's why those teachings have survived so long. They survived so long not because people have put them on a pedestal and revered them, but because people have realized them for themselves. Because they put them into practice and they've seen that this actually works. And they've achieved these very same states. Or they've seen these states in others. And they, so strong is the impression that they have gained a degree of faith. So this path of samatha vipassana, of calming the mind and opening the mind to see what's before you, is the path to all sorts of wonderful things. We start in small ways, just stepping and looking, reflecting, not always being on the run in life. We start to investigate things which we take for granted, which we pass over. We stop and we look. We understand more about the things around us. We stop and look at some of the difficulties, personal, emotional, physical, in our life. We stop and look so we can understand them. And the more we stop, the more we look, the more we understand them, the more we experience the freedom from them, the overcoming of them. How often is it that people come and do some meditation? They listen to some of the talks. And without making any great resolutions to change their life, like New Year's resolutions, which we've probably forgotten by now, 1 week later. Instead of making resolutions and making this effort, I'm going to change now, change creeps up on you. You change despite yourself. Things in your life which worried you, which made difficulties for you before, disappeared. So often it's the case, I've seen it in my own practice, my own life, I've seen it in so many other monks' lives. You don't notice, you are told by others. You change. You aren't so angry as you used to be. You aren't so touchy as you used to be. You feel more peaceful than you used to be. You feel more content than you used to be. You're smiling more than you used to last year. Where did that come from? That improvement in inner happiness. Where did it come from? I hope you can see that came from you stopping, seeing, understanding and overcoming the afflictions of the heart, the problems caused by these things. This creates greater peace, greater happiness. It's good. That's why we continue. But if you really wish to take this path of Buddhism to its limits, then you eventually will, if not in this lifetime, in the next, or another one, then one has to develop the powerful states of mind, the deep calms. When the mind is deeply calm, then you will see very clearly. The mind will be powerful enough, strong enough. I'll finish by a little simile, which is in one of the commentaries to one of the Buddhist sutras. It's a simile which is based on the imagine like India 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago. It was similar of an emperor who sent one of his sons to rule a border kingdom. You can imagine that in India, when India was unified by the Emperor Asoka, there was no way that one person could actually rule hands-on that whole vast kingdom without modern telecommunications, etc., etc. So he would have many sons, and he would send his sons or his trusted generals off to regions to be the viceroy, to be the governor. If it was his son, he could trust that, you know, he would support the father, and also it would be good training for his son for one day when one of his sons would become emperor. So this emperor sent one of his sons to a broader kingdom to rule. The first opportunity he had to go off by himself and rule a small region. After a year or two, the emperor got word back that the son wasn't ruling very well. His first years away from home were spent in partying and having a good time. You can imagine why. And not only that, he surrounded himself with five cronies, five of his mates, who were bad influence on him. So the emperor, hearing this, And understanding this was just a young man just going out into life by himself, taking responsibility for the first time. So he sent one of his wisest ministers off to explain things to his son. And this very wise minister went to the palace, the court of the son, the viceroy, and explained to him, saying that it's all right to party now and again, to enjoy yourself, but also do your business. Rule this land. Spend time working and spend time enjoying yourself. Balance your life. And then you enjoy yourself even more, and the country will be prosperous. So what did the son do? Get away with you. I'm enjoying myself. I don't need you. I'm the son of the king. I'm the viceroy here. No matter what the wise minister said, the son just ignored him. And especially his five cronies, his five friends, supported the viceroy and said, yeah, you just enjoy yourself. Just have a good time. So the wise minister had to return to the emperor saying, I tried my best. I gave all sorts of reasoned arguments, but nothing worked. So the emperor decided to send the wise minister back, but this time accompanied by one of his most powerful, fiercest generals of the army. And so they went back to his viceroy together, the strong, powerful general and the wise minister. And when they went into the court, the general just flashed his sword and the five friends scarpered. And the wise minister started talking to the viceroy, and the viceroy had the same attitude as before. Well, get away, I don't need to listen to you. And at that point, the general took hold of the viceroy, the son, by his neck, held him still, and said, you'd better listen, mate. Holding the viceroy still, the wise minister explained things to him. And holding him still and seeing, the young man understood. The five friends never came back again, and the viceroy started to rule his kingdom properly. In that simile, the wise minister was insight. Wisdom. Wisdom by itself is not strong enough. You know there are the right things to do, don't you? You can hear his teachings, you can read them. But the little viceroy inside is having a good time, thank you. And what's more, we've got five friends, and those five friends are five hindrances. I can't really go into what those five hindrances are at the moment because there's not time enough. You can read them in the books. These are the five niyamas, the five hindrances both to calm and the five hindrances also to insight, understanding. Very briefly, they are sensual desire, they are aversion or anger, they are restlessness and worry, they are sloth and torpor, they are doubt. I won't go into them because it'll take too long to explain them. It took the general is samatha, his strong mind, his calm mind, his holding the mind still, just like that general just held the viceroy still. And it's actually samatha, the calm concentration, which dispels the hindrances, which makes them scarper, makes them disappear for a long time. Once samatha, calm states of mind, deep concentration, jhana arises in the mind, the five hindrances disappear and they don't come out of hiding for a long time after. Even though the jhana may have subsided, when they come out of concentration, the hindrances do not arise for a long time after. And it was the general which held the viceroy. The viceroy is the own heart in here. The emperor was the Buddha. The inner being of you has to be held down by samatha and being given a good talking to by insight before it will change. With the two of them, things happen. Difficulties disappear, insight arises, liberation, freedom, blissful happiness, enlightenment. This is the deeper teaching of the Buddha. Instead of believing, the Buddha said, walk this path and experience this enlightenment for yourself. Calm the mind, develop insight, and these things happen naturally. And what more could we want than ultimate bliss? full understanding of these problems and questions, and we're able to live a life in harmony with others and for the benefit of others. What a wonderful thing in the world it is for an enlightened being. An enlightened being can teach others how to achieve the same. So this is the quote this evening on Samatha and Vipassana, calm and insight, and how it works from the very beginnings of the practice to the end of the practice to solve the problems of life, both philosophical, answering one's questions, emotional, overcoming negative states of mind, developing unalloyed blissful happiness, and also social problems, how we can really be a blessing in the world. Thank you.